I'm Marty Moscoe, and welcome to Radio Times. We are increasingly being surveilled by our devices, whether it's Alexa or Siri, our mobile phones, our biometric trackers, cameras at intersections, front door surveillance cameras. Advances in facial recognition technology are pushing the envelope when it comes to privacy and civil liberties. Increasingly, law enforcement is using face scanning technology at airports, from front door videos at border crossings and stadiums, to track so-called suspicious behavior. But how reliable is this technology? Can the law keep up with all these advances, and who is calling the shots? This hour, Radio Times, we look at the explosion of surveillance technology in the United States and, frankly, around the world. We have two guests who have joined us. Here in our Philadelphia studios is Hannah Bloch-Wiebe. She's an assistant professor at Drexel University's Klein School of Law, where she looks at the intersection of civil liberties and cyber issues. Hannah Bloch-Wiebe, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. And joining us by Skype is Sam Biddle. He's technology reporter for The Intercept. And Sam Biddle, nice to have you with us on the show as well.
My pleasure. Good morning.
Good morning. And to our listeners, you can join the conversation, radiotimes at whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And you can pick up the phone and give us a call the old-fashioned way, 1-888-477-9499. Let me start with a really big question, and Hannah, I'll toss this to you first. But Sam, I want you to weigh in as well. Is there any privacy anymore?
It's funny. I think it's become increasingly difficult to take steps that would prevent folks from learning private information about us, whether that's health information, our location, information about our communications patterns. And so while I think it's still possible to take those steps, it's still possible if you work hard at it to have privacy, it's no longer the default setting for our relationships and our actions in the world.
So you have to really be proactive in order to not, in a sense, be surveilled.
Exactly.
Sam, let me get you in on the conversation. I was also thinking about I think it's the frog in the frying pan, the idea that sort of slowly over time, you know, you sort of give up your civil liberties, maybe even, and your privacy as we get so used to this technology. Can you speak to that? Do we have Sam? We do not have Sam. Okay, we will figure that out. I would love to have technology that works for a radio show. I'm just going to say that and put that out there. It's been one of those weeks. But it is interesting that we have, and we were talking about this, Hannah, before going on the air, is that we, you know, there is convenience with this technology. We were talking about the fact that, and this is true for me, when I leave my house, I take my phone with me because I do need it.
Right.
At least I tell myself I need it.
Right. I think there's obviously substantial convenience, and it's transformed the way that we operate in society. So I take my phone with me because I want to know how many steps I've taken. And I take my phone with me because someone might call while I'm out. Those are substantially different expectations than I would have had even 10 years ago.
Right.
And I think, you know, it's those social expectations changing over time have ripple effects. We do expect more conveniences from modern life than I think we used to.
But is it, we've gotten so used to it, I think we don't even think about it that much.
I think we don't think about the costs of making those choices because we no longer really perceive them as meaningful choices, right? They've become the default setting. Do you put your phone in your pocket when you go out? Absolutely. Everybody does it. And so when you are accustomed to making those choices, you no longer think of them as active decisions that you've made. Once you've let them become the default in a way, you're no longer aware of the potential trade-offs. And until those trade-offs become really concrete, the costs aren't, I think, apparent either to individuals or to society as a whole.
There have been some really interesting articles recently, one actually from the New York Times having to do with this company that scrapes faces from Facebook and other sites, and then in a sense, sells that to police departments. Help us understand what's going on there.
Right. So Clearview AI is a company that allows police departments to cross-reference a photo that they've taken of an individual against a massive database of photographs that they've scraped from the public-facing web. And while police departments have been using facial recognition for a long time, they've normally screened their photos against public databases. Wow. So databases of information like mugshots or driver's license photos. The thing about Clearview that's so interesting—
And this is the company.
The company is that their database is much more massive than a database of mugshots, for example. And so it allows police to identify virtually anybody with a very, very low cost. That's what I think is really different and interesting about this company. And it's a signal of this increasing trend to shift AI sort of and facial recognition and other policing technologies toward private sector vendors who are capable of providing much more granular data than we might have expected police to have access to.
So we're talking about government over here and then the private sector over there?
Right. I think what Clearview shows is it's a private sector company that exists in order to provide services to government agencies like law enforcement. And there's a whole cottage industry of vendors that are similar. And so those vendors can their business model is geared toward providing increasingly specific and detailed information that government couldn't get on their own.
But also, and just to follow up, and then we'll get Sam in on the conversation, and making money off it too, right?
Absolutely.
I mean, just to sort of
making
close
money
the
off
loop
it.
Here. Right?
Right. That's the goal.
Is to make this profitable.
Right.
And scraping your picture, my picture, our listeners' pictures, and making that stuff available to police departments.
Right, right.
That is Hannah Block-Wiebe, and again, she's an assistant professor at Drexel University's Klein School of Law, teaches about the intersection of civil liberties and cyber issues. We're talking about things like facial recognition technology, which is really exploding and raising a whole host of questions about privacy and civil liberties. Sam Biddle, fingers crossed, joining us, technology reporter for The Intercept. And Sam, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Great to be here. Thank you.
You're very welcome. Let me just put to you the first question that I put to Hannah about whether you are watching us, in a sense, give away our privacy for the convenience of all these devices that we have.
I think that is true. I think it happened many years ago. I think that we should consider that given away largely already, unfortunately. I think that the sort of dazzling array of fun and convenience and very often just entertaining software that's become available in our pocket over the past 10 plus years has really incentivized people to make choices, uninformed choices, that trade their privacy, their autonomy potentially, for entertainment and convenience in the form of apps and so forth.
Use the word.
But that happened a while ago.
Sure. I hear and here we are, right, trying to figure out
right.
how to get through all this stuff. But you talk about uninformed. Is it the people? They don't know how to know. They don't want to know. It's too complicated to know how all this stuff works.
Oh, I mean, that is not a comment on anyone's intelligence by any means.
Sure.
I mean these are. Services, the implications of which I think are unknowable at the time you sign up for them. You know, I mean, if you upload, you're talking about Clearview. I think that's a perfect example. I mean, there's a very frightening database that has been compiled. The reporting says through things that people voluntarily put on the internet and didn't think, well, if I do this now, in a decade, will it become part of a surveillance dragnet? I mean, that isn't a choice people are prepared to make. I don't think it's a fair choice to expect, you know, consumers to make. I think it's also a big factor is the fact that the terms of services for these, whether it's apps or Alexa or whatever, are completely inscrutable. So if you want to make an informed decision about the privacy policy of some new app you've downloaded, mm-hmm. you better have a legal degree, which I don't think most people do.
Well, Hannah has a legal degree. I mean, is the law just sort of inept in dealing with all this? And it's a fast moving technology, but here we are still trying to figure out how to find this balance, assuming it exists.
I mean, I think it's striking. The law has really changed very little in terms of fundamentally shifting this dynamic that Sam is talking about, right? Even years, 20 years after the commercial internet has really come into full force, 15 years after Facebook was founded, we still rely on terms of service to advise us of what we're giving up when we go on Facebook. And the law hasn't changed to respond to that, even though we know that people don't read the terms of service and don't understand what they're consenting to.
But is the law just incapable of doing it, or there's some kind of inertia?
I think there's political inertia. There are substantial legal obstacles in some ways. But you do see in the facial recognition context increasing discussion of what the legal response ought to be and a number of different options, right? You have cities like Oakland and the suburbs of Boston, Cambridge, and Somerville banning public use of facial recognition. And you have increasingly calls for a global regulatory framework to set standards for what facial recognition regulation ought to look like. And so it's not that there couldn't be legal responses. It's we haven't gotten there yet.
Sam, you wrote about, and we'll get to Ring. I'm looking at the clock here. We'll get to Ring. But you wrote about a number of senators, including Senator Coons of Delaware, also Peters, Wyden, Van Hollen, and Markey, writing to Amazon, or writing about Amazon, I guess, and their concerns about the company. And did they get any response from what you know?
The most interesting part of the response they did get, which was mostly boilerplate about, we hold our employees to the Amazon list of values or whatever, which isn't super helpful in terms of conduct from the outside. But they did reveal that Amazon has fired 4 employees of Ring, which is Amazon's home surveillance service, for improper customer data access. They did not go into details of those incidents, what exactly was accessed, who was accessing it, whatever. But 4 people is not a small number, I think, for such a young company. You've had 4 separate instances of abuse internally. Mm-hmm. And I think that was the biggest thing that came out of that that congressional letter.
Well, let me pick up on that because Sam, you've written a lot about Ring and some of the privacy and even civil liberty issues around that. But first, we need to take a very short break. Talking with Sam Biddle, he's technology reporter for The Intercept. Hannah Bloch-Wiebe is an assistant professor at Drexel University's Klein School of Law. We're talking about surveillance technology, the explosion of surveillance technology, and some of the questions, really important questions that all of this raises about our privacy, such as it is, civil liberties, and more. Radio Times at WHYY.org. That's one way to join the conversation. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. Much more after this very short break. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen, and if you're just joining our conversation, we're looking at the explosion of surveillance technology, including facial recognition technology, both here in the United States and around the world, and the questions, the concerns raised by civil liberties and privacy questions. And again, our guests are Sam Biddle, technology reporter for The Intercept, and Hannah Bloch-Wiebe. She's a law professor at Drexel University. Sam, you wrote several articles about Amazon's Ring. This is a surveillance camera that's used in porches, or I don't know if people still have porches, but front doors and ways of so-called declaring war on the dirtbag criminals that steal our packages. Help us understand how Ring works.
Sure. So you were exactly right. It started off as a doorbell camera company. So the idea being that if you're away from home, if you're at work, if you're on vacation, what have you, someone knocks on your door or even just shows up on your front porch, maybe they're there to steal your Amazon packages, you can keep an eye on them from afar. And then there is a record of who has been by your house, essentially. And where Ring takes us in a direction beyond other comparable home surveillance video companies, of which there are several, yeah, is this overt anti-criminality law and order ethos, which I think is pretty uncommon and a bit strange for an American tech company. I mean, the crime-fighting mission, so to speak, is really ingrained in everything they do, and they're open about it. I mean, their job, if you read between the lines, is to put people in jail, which for a consumer tech company, again, is a little dicey, I think, particularly because they Ring, which was acquired by Amazon a couple years back, mm-hmm, has gone so far out of its way to seal partnerships with local police forces. This is an active, ongoing campaign of theirs to partner with local police.
Hannah,
and I think that is what's gotten a lot of civil libertarians and legal scholars and privacy experts so worried.
Sam, just a quick follow-up then. By partnering with the police, I mean, if someone has a Ring that they're using for their own personal use, does the police have access to that, or do you have to give them access to your Ring video?
Sure. So that's a great question. If in the case of most technology software companies, if the police are interested in something that you have stored on their servers, you know, let's say it's Facebook and the police want access to your Facebook messages, right, there are legal channels they're supposed to go through to obtain that stuff. What Ring has done and has sort of pioneered, I think, is they created a special portal, special access just for police to use, where they can keep track of all of the camera activity and locations on a map in their jurisdiction, and see little notifications about people reporting suspicious behavior, however that's defined. And then they can go directly to that camera user and say, hey, I'm Sergeant such and such with the police. I would like a copy of the footage that your doorbell or garage camera or whatever took last night. And that going directly to the consumer to obtain surveillance footage, even if it is voluntary technically on the part of the user, I think is a big shift.
Well, let me pick up on several things. I mean, it sounds like, Hannah, what Sam is saying is that the police already have the video, and then they're asking, is that true?
This is a system whereby the police can ask for the video.
Okay, so they can ask for the video.
The Ring owner has it, and then okay, this is the way of the police sort of virtually knocking on your door and saying, hey, can we check that out?
Does that concern you? I mean, thinking about warrants, and I mean, there are ways that law enforcement can get information.
Right. So from a legal perspective, what this does is shift police away from using formal mechanisms like search warrants or subpoenas or court orders to access this stored information, and instead asking informally or through less formal channels for consent to search. And the result is that much of this sort of information sharing is happening outside of judicial oversight channels. So we don't have an effective way of understanding how police are accessing this information other than by getting that information from Ring itself, mm-hmm, which is obviously sort of self-motivated, self-interested reporter of these statistics. And that does concern me from a democratic oversight perspective.
Because there's no judge there, right? There's no one there to say yes or no, you can have access to this information.
Right. In a way, you could see Ring itself as serving this intermediary role of overseeing these relationships between individuals and police, where prior to that, you would have thought the appropriate intermediary might have been a judge. It does concern me to have a private company serving, especially a company that has sort of identified itself with law enforcement in this way, serving in this crucial role of gatekeeping these requests.
And there is, yeah, go ahead,
that's
Sam.
Really true. Oh no, I just wanted to say I think that's exactly right. I think that a lot of people, maybe if they're served with a court order, will say, well, you know, at least the judge thought that this was valid. But like Hannah said, if police are going to you directly, it's sort of up to you to decide whether their request is reasonable or not. And I don't think that's, I mean, you know, Hannah, you're the lawyer. I don't think that's the way the system is supposed to work.
Doesn't sound that way, but go ahead, Hannah.
I think there's plenty of evidence that when police go and ask for people to voluntarily give access to information, they don't necessarily understand that that's a voluntary choice that they're making. And
absolutely.
So there are all sorts of problems with depending on voluntary consent. Folks might not understand that they can say no. And the result is that the default has shifted and given police access to substantially more information than they might otherwise have gotten.
Do we know what happened if someone says, no, I do not want to give my local police department some video of quote-unquote suspicious behavior? Do we know what happens then?
There's no legal penalty. And if the police really want that information, they can go get a court order or warrant to get access to that information. Mm-hmm. But in some instances, Sam probably knows more about this, in some instances I've heard that Ring actually does release statistics to local police saying, here are the number of people who have refused to give up their access to this footage.
Is that true, Sam?
I haven't heard that, but it would certainly not surprise me. I know that there is a lot of information sharing going on between police and Ring. There was a report last year that they had been granted in certain areas access to 911 call streams. I mean, there is sort of this odd blending of public and private infrastructure in law enforcement, which I think is again strange and new and not fully understood, and so sort of dangerous for that reason, I think.
Let me just quickly reintroduce the two of you. That's Sam Biddle. He's technology reporter for The Intercept, joining us by telephone. Hannah Bloch-Weba with us in our Philadelphia studio. She's an assistant professor of law at Drexel University's law school, and we're talking about surveillance technology and some of the concerns that it raises about privacy and civil liberties. And again, you can join us, radiotimes at whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us at 1-888-477-9499. So let me pick up on something else you said about quote-unquote suspicious behavior. How does Ring, how do police, how does anybody or can anyone really define what suspicious behavior looks like?
You know, that is a fantastic question and one that I wish Ring would answer. I've put it to them, not, you know, many other people have put it to them many times in the past. You know, suspicion or suspicious behavior in this context is the kind of thing that could potentially get people locked up if enough Ring users start complaining and worrying about them with one another, which is something else that we should introduce here, which is that Ring isn't just a camera company. They also have a sort of social network that goes along with the cameras so that you can not just follow along what's going on in your own house, but your neighbors and their friends. And that's when it starts to get, I think, particularly problematic, because you have you might have other people in your neighborhood saying, you know, I spotted this suspicious guy walking around, you know, with a hoodie and a backpack. I mean, a lot of suburban kind of phobias come into play here. And, you know, he looks suspicious to me. And the next thing you know, you might have the police asking you about that. You know, at no point has it been established that the quote unquote suspicious individual was doing anything wrong. But there they are. I had reported at the end of last year that Ring had been actively working on a feature for its camera and the social network that goes along with it that would create a suspicious activity alert on an automatic basis. So that, you know, the idea being if you're away from home, you might get a little push notification on your phone saying, we just detected suspicious activity near your house, you know, near your garage, whatever. And that is when the question that you ask, you know, how do you define suspicious, is so important because it is a term with potentially huge implications and one that we're just letting a Amazon subsidiary define in private or form out to its users.
Sure. And I do want to get to some of our listeners here. But Tana, to you, and I, as Sam was talking, I scribbled down stop and frisk. I mean, that's something that's done on the street where, you know, allegedly a suspicious looking bulge in a pair of pants is enough for the police to at least stop someone and question them. Is this some version of that with some of the same problems that goes along with it?
You could call it a grassroots form of stop and frisk, right? So if in a stop and frisk scenario, it's the police exercising their judgment about what looks suspicious with all of the problems that that entails, all of the discretion and all of the racial bias that entails. Now multiply that, you know, 10, 100 times when you have individuals with no expertise deciding what they think looks suspicious. And there are real accuracy problems here, right? I have no idea how Ring decides what suspicious activity is. That, to me, if you're looking at a camera and it flags individuals as more suspicious or less suspicious based on what they might look like, right? Which is, I think, a profound concern given that Amazon is also at the cutting edge of developing facial recognition technology. What happens when these two subsidiary sort of interests of the company start to merge? How do we see these ideas about what suspicious behavior looks like transform over time as they're taken out of police departments and into communities?
And facial recognition has been criticized for its inaccuracy when it comes to people of color. It seems like the darker the skin, the harder it is for this technology to actually work. Can you speak to that, Hannah? Or can you? I'll start with you, Hannah, and then Sam will get you in as well.
Sure. So, in a recent report, the National Institute for Standards and Technology found that they tested something like 190 facial recognition software systems. Most of them had significant problems identifying people of color, mostly African Americans and Asians, with the same degree of accuracy as they do whites. And the problem there depends on, right, how significant that bias problem is depends on what the costs are. So the costs of falsely identifying someone as a criminal suspect are significant. The costs, for example, of not being able to unlock your phone with your face are much less significant. And so context really matters in terms of how significant we might think these bias issues are. But notably, it's very difficult to study this because the information is held by software developers themselves. So you need access to their algorithms, pretty unfettered access, and to their training data in order to understand what's going on. And that's access that they have understandably been reluctant to provide.
Sam, you want to weigh in on this?
Yeah, I mean, on the general question of the general issue of racial bias and facial recognition, I sort of see it as a tough catch-22, because on the one hand, it's obviously unfair, right? I mean, just on the face of it, no pun intended, that if it works better on certain people than does on others, that's especially, you know, problematic in a legal setting. But it makes me wonder what the solution to that is, because I think it's a little strange to say, okay, we're going to fix this question of racial inaccuracy by making this technology work better at, you know, ensnaring people of color. I mean, that also, you know, who are, you know, disproportionately affected under the legal system anyway. So to make facial recognition better at detecting and finding oppressed minorities, to me, doesn't seem like a good way out of this dilemma. And I think that is one of the best arguments to be made for banning this technology in public until it works, or maybe permanently. But I mean, I'm curious, Hannah, what you think about that, the idea of addressing this imbalance by making it more effective, which I think is has its own problems.
To deal with the racial disparity, but whether that opens the door.
Right. I think Sam's absolutely right, right? Like making these systems fairer and more accurate will only lead to a more dystopian future in which they're more difficult to avoid. And I think that's exactly why you have critics of these technologies arguing not in favor of making them hyper accurate, but instead of restricting their use or banning them altogether, restricting their development. And I think what we see is sort of a shifting climate when it comes to facial recognition in particular, in which cities and states and even increasingly Congress are willing to think about a moratorium. I think those sort of political moves are happening. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, you have industry pushing back very strongly, saying private use of this technology is not only sort of underway, it's a good thing and people want it. And I think politicians are going to have to strike a balance between these fears of a dystopian present, really, not even a future, and the consumer conveniences that, as Sam was saying earlier, we've all sort of unknowingly, unwittingly become accustomed to and desirous of.
We're almost about to break here, Hannah, but if we're talking about the dystopian present, are we talking about China?
I mean, there was just a story recently about China's use of facial recognition to identify and shame people who wore pajamas in public. And I think that's
is coming from the government, right?
Right. I think it's a great example of a technology that we've been promised would make us safer, in fact, being turned around in a deeply oppressive way. And I think that is what we should expect.
Well, let's take that break and then we'll get back to our conversation. And we want you to join our conversation as well, talking about surveillance technology, facial recognition technology, and the host of questions, concerns that this technology raises about things like civil liberties and privacy. And again, Hannah Bloch-Weba, Assistant Professor of Law at Drexel University's School of Law, and Sam Biddle, Technology Reporter for The Intercept. We've got some folks that want to join our conversation. You can do as well. Radio Times at WHYY.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us at 1-888-477-9499. Much more after this very short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane. Let me just recap here. We're talking about the fact that our habits, our movements, our faces are being captured by surveillance cameras, whether they're on your neighbor's front porch or city streets or storefronts or someone's phone. And with advances in facial recognition technologies, these devices, apps, and algorithms know exactly who we are. And the question is, are we okay with that? Email from Dave who says, I don't think you're giving the people enough credit. We know that we're trading some of our privacy for absolutely amazing stuff. When surveillance technology becomes overbearing, people will stop consuming it. What do you think about that, Sam?
I have to respectfully disagree. I think that that is making a big assumption that people will reach that point where they, you know, everyone looks up one day and says it's all gone too far, and throw our phones in the river. I don't think that's how it's going to work. I think this stuff becomes so integrated into your daily life. It is so integrated into so many of our daily lives that at a certain point, unless its growth and progress is slowed or halted, it will be impossible or virtually impossible to rid yourself of this stuff in the same way that it would be hard to, stop using email or Wi-Fi. It becomes a technology that's just a commonplace.
We've been talking about the downsides of all this stuff, Hannah, but I'm thinking about how facial recognition and some of this other surveillance technology can find missing people or can, find actual criminals and the use of some of this technology for the common good.
I think there are absolutely ways in which facial recognition can help law enforcement in really important settings. And the identifying criminals and crime victims and missing people. Those are the kinds of settings that law enforcement is always talking about when
exactly.
it's touting the value of facial recognition. But that doesn't mean that their use of this technology should be totally unfettered and unrestricted by the law itself, right? To me, that suggests that in certain cases, it's totally appropriate to get a court order that permits the use of facial recognition technology. But it doesn't suggest to me that law enforcement should have access to a database provided by a private vendor of every photograph ever uploaded to Facebook or Twitter and be able to comb through it at will with no oversight at all.
A comment from Kathy saying, I wonder about voice recognition and if that might be in the future. Sam, have you looked at that?
Yeah, something that I think, well, first of all, that again, that's not the future. That's our present. I mean, anyone who's used Alexa or Siri, I mean, these are services that are designed to recognize our voices. The Intercept had done some reporting a year or two back that the NSA has been very interested in so-called voice printing. But yeah, I mean, I think that our voice, like our face, is something we think of as unique to us and something that we don't think of as being able to track us down or reveal more than we want to about ourselves. Mm-hmm. It's something that I don't think we think of as being, you know, the genie out of the bottle, sort of, you know. I mean, we've been groomed to speak to computers and phones and apps for so long that, that also just feels sort of commonplace.
I mean, it is all so Skinnerian, so behavioral, and that you get rewarded. I'm looking at you, Hannah. You get rewarded in that sort of rat in the maze kind of way when you get a little beep and or a little sound that comes from your phone that tells you that somebody wants to tell you something or perhaps sell you something.
Right, absolutely. I think our behaviors have shifted in response to the technologies that we use, and that's continuing to happen. And actually, the technology companies know the most about how those behavioral changes are taking place because they study them in order to be able to develop more, right? It's a feedback loop that I think we don't fully as consumers understand.
I read Dave's email. Let me read the tweet from Aaron, who says, my big concern is that my neighbor's Ring doorbells are monitoring my house and my neighbors get to decide how much information to give the police about me. Sam, can I toss that back to you? And I mean, a Ring does look out on the street, so you're going to see cars going by. You're going to see people walking their dogs, walking their, you know, their children around or
yep.
whatever. Whatever's on the street there is captured by that camera.
That is such an important point. And I think it's worth pointing out also that whenever I personally have raised these issues of consent with Ring, they always say, look, this is an opt-in service. You choose where you put the camera. You choose to share clips with your neighbors. You choose to share information with the police. But exactly as that listener has pointed out, if I am, the mailman or your friend or your neighbor or literally anyone walking down the street past your house, I have now become sucked into this thing that you've opted into. You know, I didn't opt into anything, but the technology makes no differentiation between the person who bought the camera and hung it up and clicked the checkbox to opt in, and any other human being who's caught in the frame.
But if someone has this technology, let's say Ring, I mean, they're not going to spend their evening looking at people driving by their house or walking on the sidewalk. I mean, we're not busybodies like that. We don't really have time to do that. I mean, if it's just being captured but nothing is happening to it, is it a problem?
Well, the second part of that question, I think, is doing a lot of work. I mean, we have to just take Ring, Amazon at their word when they say that nothing is happening to it, right? Maybe that is the case now, but will it be the case in a few years? I mean, if Ring is sitting on this enormous trove of footage captured from garages and front doors and sidewalks around the country, what, you know, maybe they'll want to do something different with it in a few years. And if you happen to deliver a package to that house, you know, in 2017, mm-hmm. You may still be in the system in some way. I think it's also worth bringing up that Ring got in some hot water last year after it was revealed that contractors in Ukraine that they used to pour over this video data and improve the software were improperly accessing it and could look at anyone's video from any house in the country. So, you know, when you do just have an enormous pool of data like that, it can become tempting for people who aren't supposed to be looking at it to poke around and be busybodies.
And let me go back to you, and then we'll get some more of our listeners in on the conversations. So is there some kind of a legal fix? I mean, we have a model from the past. Is there a way to update it so that we can address some of the civil liberties concerns?
With Ring specifically?
Or just this all this surveillance technology?
Yeah. So, I mean, there's a menu of options, right? The most aggressive being ban it, which a number of people are and serious critics of this technology are calling for an outright ban because they don't believe that the positive uses can possibly outweigh the negative social effects. There's a moratorium proposal. Even the CEO of Google, which also develops facial recognition, has called for a moratorium on its development in light of the absence of a regulatory framework. I think from law enforcement's perspective, the most appealing sort of framework would be a use regulation. So how can we constrain without eliminating the use of these technologies, right? And there, I think you do have to go back to first principles and mm-hmm. say court orders have worked in this setting for a long time. Warrant requirements have worked for a long time. And if you're investigating a specific crime, then there's no reason why you couldn't be able to go to a court and demonstrate probable cause that would support your application for a search warrant. And I think that's, you know, erecting those legal barriers is important because it gives clear guidance to law enforcement on what the boundaries are for what they're permitted to do. And it gives clear guidance to us as citizens.
Well, I would also think that if people are defining suspicious behavior in all sorts of ways, you could drive a police department crazy with all sorts of false alarms.
I'm sure there's a flood of information that's not particularly helpful, but I think Sam is right that in the long term, we can't predict how much of this footage is going to be used in the future, in future applications.
A call from John picking up what we said earlier. It says we're focusing too much on privacy when we should talk about the positive potential of this technology in crime reduction. And I put this to Hannah, but Sam, if you want to jump in on that, just your thoughts. Do we have Sam?
Oh, yes. Sorry.
That's okay.
I think that it is true, as Hannah said, that no doubt the use of ubiquitous surveillance will help catch more criminals. I think that if we gave the police permission to tap literally everyone's phones at all times without reason or warning, that would also probably catch a lot of criminals. Mm-hmm. I think that, you know, our legal system is set up to be, to not permit the maximum possible law enforcement investigation, you know, that I'm sure they would love to do. I mean, we constrain what resources, what information police are allowed to have because the idea of giving them access to everything is as frightening as crime. I mean, I think that's supposed to be the idea, at least. But we have to think about what other technologies are comparable. I mean, if police had unfettered access to everyone's email account, that would probably put some, you know, kidnappers and molesters away. But I don't think that we would think of that as an acceptable trade-off.
Let me read some more comments. One from Tony: I can't even walk down my driveway to get my mail without worrying about being recorded on my neighbor's cameras. A comment from Nicole: sidewalks are public spaces, and I'm worried that these cameras take public space and make it private. Can you think your way through that? I mean, it is interesting. I mean, once you put cameras out there, what's public, what's private? But sidewalks are public spaces, yes?
Sidewalks are public spaces. I think when you train a Ring camera on the sidewalk outside your home, it's almost like you've transformed that sidewalk into your property by virtue of taking footage of it. That doesn't mean that you're not permitted to do that, right? Of course, you can go and take photos in a public space whenever you want.
Right.
But I think that people are concerned about this sort of virtual enclosure, right? That what you do in public space that used to be obscure to people is no longer obscure. And in fact, it's now increasingly the subject of a persistent record of where you are and what you're doing. And that, I think, is concerning. People have different intuitions about this, right? People have different sort of senses of how much privacy they are willing to give up in favor of a professed interest in crime reduction. And we can't make those decisions as individuals. We have to trust that our political and legal and social institutions will help us make them.
Mm.
And so far, that hasn't really been happening.
Here's a tweet from Abby Sam, who says, what about facial recognition algorithms being tested on unwilling populations in undemocratic settings? And then ask what Microsoft-funded AnyVision does to Palestinians. Do you know anything about that? Sam?
I'm not familiar enough with that specific application to comment on it, but I do think the broader question of who we are using as test subjects and what sorts of people are demographically being used to train these technologies, I think is a fantastic and very valuable question. I think that there you can get into a sort of class based analysis of who tends to upload who is going to upload their face to a free app versus a piece of technology that might cost money but have a more strict privacy policy. Mm. I mean, who is using the free version of software that comes with more exploitative privacy rules, as well, versus someone who can afford to use something that doesn't? I think that is a really great question that deserves more scrutiny.
Gotcha. Almost out of time here. So, Hannah, are there things people should not do if they want to protect their privacy? And they, everyone has their own version of what they want to protect, but sort of some guidelines?
I think not installing a Ring camera is probably a great start if you're concerned about your privacy. I think, unfortunately, as we've been discussing throughout the hour, I think a lot of these choices are no longer our own. And so to a certain degree, we're sort of unwilling participants in other folks' choices.
Mm-hmm.
But we can choose not to use applications and hardware that track us and share that information with law enforcement upon request.
And Sam, any final thoughts before we say goodbye?
I think that one thing people can do, maybe if they're feeling frustrated and powerless and don't feel like waiting on Congress to do anything about this, is to just talk with their friends and maybe even your neighbors if you're comfortable with that. I mean, if you have people in your life who are using these technologies, they may be doing so just sort of reflexively because it's convenient or fun and But a conversation about the implications we've been discussing for the past hour, I think, can be really illuminating. And I think maybe change might happen from that direction. So I would encourage people to do that if they feel up for it.
All right, we got to leave it there. Sam Biddle, thanks so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
My pleasure.
And he's a technology reporter for The Intercept. Hannah Block-Wiebe, thank you for joining us as well.
Thank you so much.
And she's a law professor at Drexel University. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes and you can find out more about the program. Adam Staniszewski, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thank you so much for joining us.